This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, June 6th of 2023. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, we'll hear about a new photography exhibit at NCAR, which looks at the effects of climate change through Indigenous communities on the front line. Manufacturers of PFAS compounds took a page from the tobacco playbook and hid the dangers of so-called forever chemicals. That story and more in This Week in Water. And we'll go to our comment line to hear what's on the minds of listeners. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines. Then it's How on Earth. Host Beth Bennett has a conversation with author John Valiant about his new book, Fire Weather. At 9 a.m. comes another archival recording of The Wit and Wisdom of Alan Watts. Then at 9:30, James Wise will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all still ahead, but first it's time for the headlines. With KGNU's John Cowan.
Today is municipal runoff election day in Denver as voters decide between mayoral candidates Mike Johnston and Kelly Broff, and some districts elect their city council representatives. Ballots are due in secure drop boxes, or voters must be in line by 7 p.m. at in-person polling places for the votes to count. Voter participation has been a little better than usual, according to Colorado Newsline. They report that the Denver Clerk and Recorder's Office says 18.6% of eligible voters have returned a ballot as of late last week. The Denver Post says it's the highest ballot return rate since at least 2011. Johnston and Broff got 24.5% and 20% of the vote, respectively, in the April election. That wasn't enough for either to claim an outright win, setting up today's runoff. In addition to deciding the next mayor, four Denver City Council seats will be filled by today's voting. Seats are open in Districts 7, 8, 9, and 10. The latter three are contested races. Only one candidate remains in the District 7 race after one of the contenders dropped out. Results of the election may not be known for a day or so. Election officials say the priority today is scanning ballots as quickly and efficiently as possible. Up to 1,000 demonstrators staged a sit-in at the state capitol in Denver yesterday. KGNU's Jacob Agatston has the story.
The protesters are demanding Governor Jared Polis sign an executive order banning all firearms in Colorado. They joined hundreds of women from across the U.S. pushing for gun reform at the Colorado State Capitol on Monday and say they will return every day until Polis meets their demands. The organization Here for the Kids planned this sit-in and are asking Polis to sign their drafted executive order to ban guns and implement a statewide buyback program. Here for the Kids is a national group founded by two women of color who are calling on only white women to participate in the protest by putting their bodies on the ground, as marginalized communities have always done. In a statement, Here for the Kids said that historically, white women are least likely to be brutalized by police. Organizers are asking white women to support the movement by participating in an act of civil disobedience to demand change. Monday's rally in Denver comes just after Moms Demand Action staged gun safety events across the country. At a rally in Louisville Saturday, Moms Demand Action activist Erica Chapman told KGNU why she thinks the issue is so important.
You know, I came to be involved in this work just by being in this country, by being not afraid of if my life will be violated by gun violence, but when it will be. And that is a terrifying thought for me.
Governor Polis released a statement Monday that said he shares their concerns over public safety, but that his staff met with the organizers and expressed concerns the group's requests were either unconstitutional or require legislative action. For KGNU, I'm Jacob Agatston.
The Club Q shooting in Colorado Springs last year could have been prevented if the El Paso County Sheriff had used existing extreme risk protection order measures. That claim is the basis of a lawsuit expected to be filed by survivors and family members against the El Paso County Sheriff's Office. Authorities jailed the nightclub shooting suspect a year before the Club Q attack for counts of felony menacing and kidnapping. The court ultimately filed no charges against the suspect and sealed the court records. Five people were killed and 17 others wounded in the shooting at the gay nightclub last November. The suspect is facing more than 300 criminal charges. A Denver woman is challenging a Colorado law that prohibits anti-abortion activists from getting too close to women who are entering an abortion clinic. The 1993 state law prohibits anti-abortion activists from getting within 8 feet of women entering clinics. That so-called 8-foot bubble law is only in effect within 100 feet of a service provider's location. The United States Supreme Court upheld the 8-foot bubble law in 2000, but with the High Court overturning Roe v. Wade last summer, Denver's Wendy Faustin is challenging the law on the grounds that it violates her right to free speech. The Denver Post says that a line in last year's Supreme Court ruling singled out the Colorado law as distorted First Amendment doctrine. The family of a Colorado Springs man killed after he was allegedly taken hostage is asking why police failed to respond to an emergency 911 call, which they believe might have saved the man's life. Quaylen Campbell, a 32-year-old black man and father, was killed last Friday, reportedly less than 1 mile from Colorado Springs police headquarters. Campbell's widow and her lawyer have scheduled a news conference for this afternoon outside of police headquarters as they search for answers. According to a press release from the family's lawyer, Quaylen Campbell's body was found after police received an emergency call early Friday afternoon. That call reported that two people had been found unconscious in a car. But Campbell's wife says she called 911 nearly an hour before that. She says that in this earlier call, she reported that her husband had sent an apparent text message indicating he'd been taken hostage. That message included a picture of the alleged captor and Campbell's location. The family's lawyer said Quaylen Campbell was clearly begging for his life. His wife called 911, but police did not respond. $390,000 in federal funding is on its way to the town of Superior to help restore stormwater infrastructure lost to or damaged by the December 2021 Marshall Mesa fire and wind event. Colorado Congressman Joe Neguse announced the funding yesterday. He said the investments are made possible by the historic bipartisan infrastructure law. Meanwhile, the city of Boulder is updating its community wildfire protection plan for 2024. The city is updating the plan through a partnership with SWCA Environmental Consultants. They'll recommend strategies to address the biggest risk factors related to wildfires. The Lunar New Year is now an official holiday in Colorado. Governor Jared Polis signed a bill declaring the first Friday of every February the Lunar New Year. Colorado becomes just the second state in the country to recognize the holiday after California. Lunar New Year is a holiday widely celebrated across East Asia. Supporters of the bill recognizing the holiday on a state level say they're elated, calling Friday's bill signing a historic moment. In today's weather outlook, mostly sunny skies early on, but chances are good we'll continue the rainy cycle we're in. The National Weather Service says that after early sun, there's a 50% chance of showers and thundershowers, mostly after 3 p.m. That may continue into the evening. The high in Denver today, 78 degrees, a high of 73 in Boulder, 75 in Fort Collins, and in Nederland, expect a high of 61 degrees. For KGNU, I'm John Kellen.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. A new photography exhibit at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, or NCAR, lab in Boulder looks at the effects of climate change through the lens of Indigenous communities on the front line. The Preserving Our Place, Knowledge is Power exhibit opened Thursday in conjunction with the annual Rising Voices Center for Indigenous and Earth Sciences workshop. KGNU news volunteer Elena Claver was there and spoke with two of the artists.
My name is Chantel Carmadel, and I am from Louisiana, from the Jean Charles Choctaw Nation, and we just set up a beautiful photo exhibit about our communities and climate change and how our Indigenous communities are handling it.
And I'm Dennis Davis. I'm from a small village in Shishmaref, Alaska, and I partnered with the tribe down in Elder John Charles for this exhibit.
So you both are from pretty far ends of Turtle Island, and tell us about what the motivation for doing this exhibit was.
So really, it's just to kind of educate other communities that what's going on in our particular communities and how the similarities and how we're dealing with it, but also how we just, even though all these horrible things are happening to our community, we still see all the beauty and all the culture and still the resilience in our people, in our communities.
My whole thing is to just let people know what's happening, because like in Shishmaref, we're a couple thousand miles away from Elder John Charles, and it's basically what's happening in Shishmaref is happening down there in the bayou. And it's, a lot of people don't understand. They think climate change isn't real, but it's actually happening, and you can see it firsthand between the both the places. And if we don't do anything and we don't, you know, educate people about what's happening, then we're just, you're going to start seeing this more and more all over the place, not just in the United States, but around the world.
And you both are here as part of Rising Voices. Could you talk about that effort and where people can learn more information about each of your communities and also efforts to bring Indigenous wisdom into the climate change conversations?
Yeah, so Rising Voices is a wonderful community of Indigenous people that just have got together and are just doing like what we're doing, getting the word out to other tribes that are dealing with climate issues, other peoples, Indigenous peoples around the world that's dealing with climate issues, not just from sea level rise like us, but also flooding and droughts and fires. So it's just a wonderful place to network and just build camaraderie and build togetherness. If we work as one unified group of people, we can really make some change in this world for the positive. So you can find information on the exhibit at preservingourplace.com, and you can also look up Rising Voices on the web and just see how you can get plugged into the Climate Serve, into the community of us that are just trying to get our voices out there and get the stories, the real stories from the frontline communities that are dealing with these issues out to the public.
Yeah, that's basically what I want to make sure is happening. It's just that people understand that, you know, this is real, it's happening. And just to let them know that it's affecting our village, it's affecting our lifestyle, it's affecting our food, because we live basically on a subsistence lifestyle in a village. My village is about 700 people, and the only way you can get in is either you fly in or you take a boat or a snow machine in the wintertime, and it's about as remote as you can get. And people just don't understand that, you know, this stuff is happening.
And the exhibit at NCAR, how long will it be up until?
It's actually be up until August 20th, so you can see it at the Mesa Lab at NCAR, and feel free to go in and look and just see what's going on.
Okay, any other final words that you'd like to share with the audience?
I love this place, but it's just, like I said, where I'm at right now, we're still in winter, and it's hot. It's really hot.
We're so thankful that NCAR opened up to our exhibit to come and just share with this part of the country the things that are happening. And it's a beautiful facility. I encourage anyone to go and see what they're doing there. It's a beautiful place.
Thanks to KGNU volunteer Elena Claver for sharing that interview. The effects of melting permafrost and thawing river ice in Arctic communities is a topic explored by CU Boulder Environmental Sciences student Vivian Pham in this report
on climate change impacts entire landscapes across the Arctic. Nicole Herman Mercer is a social scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey who works as co-principal investigator with the Arctic Rivers Project.
The permafrost is thawing in a lot of areas, which is has impacts on the stability of infrastructure. It also has potential to increase contamination in the rivers and some of their drinking water sources, because as the permafrost thaws, then these new pathways in the groundwater open up that weren't there previously. And so more contaminants that may have been frozen in the soil can be released and then end up in the water.
Dr. Olga Olturgasheva, an Indigenous scholar and senior lecturer at the University of Manchester, offers additional insight on permafrost thawing.
The kind of climate change dynamic that is undergoing is associated with the dramatic permafrost melt, you know, thaw. And because where Avena reindeer herders move and leave, these are all permafrost-bound land, you know, so their entire livelihoods, their subsistence, also safety and security of their reindeer herds depends so much on this complex ecology, that is dependent on permafrost, you know.
The Yaveni are a community of reindeer herders and are indigenous to Siberia. As a member of the Yaveni community, Dr. Olturkasheva has noticed several ways that climate change impacts our community.
Of course, reindeer herders notice that because their movements are getting more dangerous. Their hunting is less, let's say, stable than before. The number of domestic reindeers reducing dramatically. And all of that, of course, affects their everyday lives and everyday, you know, sense of safety.
Besides permafrost thaw, a warming climate means increasingly thinner river ice. During winter, some Arctic indigenous communities rely on stable river ice. They drive snow machines and sometimes trucks across stable river ice to transport supplies, visit family, and to reach hunting or fishing grounds.
Increasingly, in the winter, the rivers have started to flow. So that in response to a warm storm event, for example, where historically it used to be all frozen and snowfall allowed for safe passage.
Keith Musselman is a research professor at the University of Colorado Boulder, and he also works as a principal investigator for the Arctic Rivers Project.
Now those rivers are starting to get disturbed and the water is flowing. It's jumbling the ice, it refreezes, and then it creates a really unsafe travel thoroughfare for particularly their fishers and their hunters, who are often youth or in their 20s, and they have to travel long distances along these rivers to reach their hunting grounds or their fishing grounds. And so there are fatalities that are being reported, and those are some of the more recent changes that we've been seeing.
In terms of adaptation to impacts, it's necessary to center Indigenous knowledge and perspectives. Musselman and Herman Mercer are both researchers with the Arctic Rivers Project, which is guided by an Indigenous Advisory Council.
There is a need and there is a information currency that is flowing back and forth. And in our case, we're trying to bring together Indigenous knowledge with Western science to improve our understanding of how the landscape is changing and what the adaptation possibilities are for Indigenous communities who are really on the front line of climate change impacts and the first to experience a lot of those impacts.
Arctic Indigenous communities are diverse in ways of thinking and knowing. It will also be important for adaptation strategies to account for the local nuances of climate issues.
When it comes to the question of adaptation, there should be a really careful and detailed consideration of local nuances. You know, how do we take into account, again, human-animal relations, subsistence patterns, because subsistence patterns, for example, of Yaveni reindeer herders, that is very much dependent on reindeer herding and hunting of land animals, are very kind of different and distinct from, let's say, subsistence patterns of Alaskan Yupik, who are marine hunters. They depend very much on seals and beluga whales, for example, or salmon. So that these are different, distinct ecologies on which humans depend. So all that has to be taken into account.
Thanks to CU Boulder Environmental Sciences student Vivian Pham for that report. Up next is This Week in Water with Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
They knew the dangers but hid them from the public. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Chemical companies that made PFAS compounds knew that their products caused health issues, but hid that information for decades from the public, regulators, and their own employees.
A new study from the University of California, San Francisco shows that the industry took a page from the tobacco playbook to delay public awareness about the toxicity of so-called forever chemicals, which break down very slowly in the environment.
The chemicals have been linked to serious health effects, including liver and immune system damage and some cancers. They have been used widely in products such as clothing, packaging, and firefighting foam, among others, and are found everywhere on Earth, contaminating water, soils, and wildlife.
The authors say industry executives had evidence of toxicity and documents were marked confidential. In some cases, executives were explicit that they wanted memos destroyed.
The study was published just days before three companies, including DuPont, said they reached a settlement of the first of many lawsuits based on PFAS contamination.
The companies will pay over $1 billion to help some water systems, and it was reported that 3M has also settled a suit for nearly 10 times that.
But this is not the end of all PFAS litigation, as over 4,000 lawsuits have been filed against chemical companies.
The governor of Arizona, Katie Hobbs, announced last week that there won't be any new housing developments in the Phoenix metro area if they rely solely on groundwater.
The announcement received much national attention as it may portend the effect of the current drought and climate change on projects, particularly housing in the drying West.
The state gets more than 40% of its supply from groundwater. Arizona has already voluntarily reduced the water it receives from the Colorado River, and now state leaders are recognizing that there's not enough groundwater to meet demand over the next century.
A study by the Arizona Department of Water Resources concluded that groundwater has been overpumped for decades as the state has continued to rely on it. According to the New York Times, Maricopa County, with Phoenix and its sprawling suburbs, uses twice as much water as New York City, but has only half as many people.
Attracting new companies to relocate to the state is a major part of local economies, but the announcement about home building may jeopardize that.
The governor said last Thursday that the state was not immediately running out of water and that there would still be new construction in cities that already have shown they have a 100-year supply.
Vehicles contribute to climate change by releasing greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, but according to a new study, cars and trucks are a hidden source of other pollution, and it's not coming from tailpipes.
Researchers from University of York in the UK found that volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, that produce smog come not only from exhaust but also from windshields.
That's because wiper fluid contains not only water, but also alcohols meant to tackle everything from bird poop to road grime, as well as small amounts of antifreeze to keep it flowing in cold temperatures. Those VOCs are easily vaporized and can contribute to climate warming.
The authors found that two alcohols in wiper fluid, ethanol and methanol, were nearly twice the amount of all VOCs released in exhaust, a much larger fraction of real-world vehicle emissions than previously thought.
And while more electric vehicles will be huge in reducing greenhouse gases, EVs will need to clean their windshields too, so the authors say VOCs in wiper fluids and other car care products, emissions once hidden in plain sight, will need to be factored into future regulatory policies. And finally, beetles are among the largest group of animals on the planet, and the vast majority of them are weevils, an insect many consider a pest for sometimes munching on pasta and grains in our pantries. And of course, there are boll weevils, which gained notoriety starting in the late 1800s for devastating cotton crops in the American South.
But according to new research by the Field Museum in Chicago, weevils aren't evil. They're actually unsung heroes of pollination, less studied than celebrities like bees and butterflies that flit from flower to flower.
Weevils, on the other hand, want a long-term serious relationship with a plant to settle down and start a family. They're known as brood site pollinators because the insects spend their whole life with a plant, both pollinating them and using them as breeding sites for their larvae.
The next closest thing in nature is the connection between monarchs and milkweed, which is the only plant their caterpillars will eat, and the place where the butterflies lay their eggs. However, monarchs will happily feast on many flowers.
Misconceptions about weevils have made them enemy number one with farmers, but weevil species pollinate plants from orchids to date palms, and the researchers say they want to reintroduce a group of insects that most people want to kill, but are actually benefiting us and ecosystems we depend on.
That's it for This Week in Water, which is sponsored today by our contributory, Guy Till of Colorado.
Guy said, "I support H2O Radio because the stories are both educational and entertaining."
Thanks for listening, Guy. See you next week.
Time now to check in with KGNU's listener comment line.
I'm a decades-long Denver listener, and I felt I needed to express my disappointment with removing the Saturday evening BBC hour. I have tried to post some communication, and the response seemed to suggest that it was primarily decision from the music director, and I was answered saying that this was an improvement to provide more consistency, and that's baffling to me. I think what it's doing is creating one day of the week, Saturday, where it's strictly music other than the headlines. And in my estimate, the five-minute headlines doesn't come close or isn't comparable to the NewsHour program. I've heard many stories, often global, international, that aren't covered elsewhere, and so I feel like we're really losing quite a bit by that Saturday hour being removed and replaced. So I really hope the station will reconsider. I was told it was primarily a decision by the music director. It sure seems to me that news should be at least as much a priority, and that would be a significant part of that. Thank you.
To clarify, the decision to replace the Saturday edition of the BBC NewsHour with the locally produced music show Corriente was not the sole decision of the music director. With just about any programming change to KGNU's lineup, it was discussed by the entire program committee. As someone who participated in that discussion and supports the music director's proposal, I can say one of the factors in the decision was the amount of airtime the BBC already has on KGNU. Even with the replacement of the Saturday edition of the NewsHour, the BBC has more airtime than any other news program on KGNU. We know it's a popular program, and we know that information needs to continue throughout the weekend. That's why we kept in the 5 minutes of headlines at the top of the 6 p.m. hour. We hope listeners will value the uninterrupted Saturday music programming, which is already very popular. Thank you for contributing your opinion, and that comment was edited for time because we are out of time right now. That's all for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Thanks to John Kellen, Steve Miller, Jacob Agatston, Elena Claver, Vivian Pham, Jamie Sudler, Franny Halperin, interns Poor Jai Jung Kit, and Kira Zizzo, who are shadowing me live in the studio today. Stay tuned for How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show on the other side of the BBC.